Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everyone, and welcome to this week's episode. My guest today is Dr. Brendan Stubbs, who is a multi-award-winning scientist and innovator who combines the best-in-class, uncompromising science with integrity in a way that resonates with the public. Brendan has published over 800 international academic papers. Yes, you heard me right. Pretty impressive. And has been identified as being in the top 0.1% of researchers globally in mental health and neuroscience since 2019. As a result of this, expect many mic drop moments and lots to be learned across the next hour as we delve into the huge subject of exercise and mental health. Brendan, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, thanks, Alice. And how are you?
I am very good, thank you. Yeah, I'm really good. Now, I guess my first question for you is to ask about your journey to where you find yourself in your career now. I said in my introduction that you find yourself being one of the top 0.1% of researchers globally in mental health and neuroscience. That's a pretty incredible stat. So did you always want to work in this field, or what was your kind of journey to where you find yourself now?
Oh, I wish I could say it was like a really nicely planned out career route and I've kind of like followed these really nice steps, but it's not absolutely been like that. I did physiotherapy as my first degree, and to be honest, I didn't really take to it a lot. I thought it was okay, but I wasn't really like, wow. And then I think I went soon after graduating, I went to go and work in a mental health hospital, and I was working with some people who were really chronically depressed, really unwell in 2003. And I just started going on there, trying to get people moving, getting people outdoors, getting people change their lifestyle. I just thought, wow, this is fascinating, because the setup then was just like people were very sedentary, only really going out for a cigarette. And I just thought, wow, we could make such a difference here. And nobody told me about this wonderful world where we can use movement to improve the lives of people who are really struggling with their mental health. So that kind of set me off on a path. And then as I sort of progressed along this path, I thought, where's the evidence for this stuff? I mean, it's common sense that movement is good for your mental health, but where's the data? Where's the evidence? And then I kind of went on a bit of a journey with that and doing research on a very low-key level initially, then sort of expanded sort of with other people across the local region, then the UK and further afield. And one thing led to another. And then we've done a lot of studies and having a good time trying to prove the science around how movement makes us feel and what the science is behind it.
It's always the way, isn't it, that the sort of anecdotal stuff comes first and then people like you come along and go, well, we need to prove it because we need evidence to back up like these kind of big statements of exercise improves our mental health. Okay, well, let's prove it. So you are the person that's just doing that, and that's amazing. And I think if we just take a step back before we kind of go into the more granular detail, let's talk about the connection between mental health and exercise. You know, you sort of said that statement, we know that exercise is good for our mental health, but what are the big take homes in your experience as to what we know thus far about that big connection between our brain and moving our body?
So I think there's three really key areas I'd like to mention where we've come hugely in terms of like science and what we know. So the first area is around prevention and promotion of better mental health and preventing mental illnesses developing. And we've shown through lots of individual studies and collective studies that generally higher levels of physical activity are protective against the emergence of depression and anxiety by around 15% at a population level. At an individual level, there's always lots going on for us, and it can really vary. So if you're moving lots, it doesn't mean you're not going to get that. But at a population average level, we've shown that there's really good evidence that it can protect us. So that's the first thing, by around 15%. And if people meet recommended guidelines, by up to 30%. And also to bolster those findings, there's some studies called Mendelian randomization, where we've looked at sort of genetic pathways between movement and genes for people being at risk for depression, just to bolster those findings that movement protects. And within that, we're also looking at the influence of fitness. And broadly speaking, how is our cardiorespiratory fitness, or how well our heart and lungs respond to exercise, and also our muscular strength. And again, we've seen the similar thing, that if you stimulate cardiorespiratory fitness in people with higher levels of cardiorespiratory fitness, we see a reduced risk of depression and anxiety in the future. And we see a similar thing with muscular strength, that people who train their muscles have good muscular strength are less likely in the future. But you get the best bang for your buck when you focus on combining all of those things, moving more, getting your heart and lungs fit, and also your strength. So that is a key area, first and foremost. So huge strides within that prevention and promotion. And then within the treatment realm, we've made huge progress too. So there's lots of what we call randomized control trials and reviews of those trials, which have shown, whether it's depression or anxiety or other conditions such as schizophrenia, that as an added on benefit, that you can get meaningful improvements in depressive symptoms, anxiety symptoms, and even symptoms of schizophrenia with supervised exercise. And that could be any number of different types of exercise, and some really sort of exciting findings within that. And then sort of the other area, which is really exciting, is we've been trying to understand why, and the big why, and I'm sure we'll come on to that later, but there's some really cool sides where we've been cutting through to say, is this just, you know, a nice fluffy thing, or is there some real hard things happening within the body and the mind? And so that's really exciting too. So those are the three key areas we've made huge strides in the last 20 years.
Amazing. And I think that, you know, it's really good that you break it down into those three categories, because I think on a day-to-day level, most people listening to this will probably relate mostly to that first one. But as we move into the second and the third, I think it's fascinating what we now know about those kind of structural changes that can happen within the brain due to exercise. And also then, like, looking forwards, you know, and understanding the role of exercise on teaching generations is really exciting too. Just taking up, you know, the first kind of pillar, let's say, of what you were talking about, the prevention aspect, you mentioned sort of the higher levels of exercise there. I just wanted to pick up on that. So do we know if there's sort of a minimum effective dose when it comes to what we need to be doing for our mental health? And is there sort of a threshold at which this plateaus? And I ask this because you know, when I was preparing for this interview, I went onto your Instagram and I saw that you did a really fascinating and really great post about this sort of prevalence of mental health in athletes, and that those who sort of have very high levels of exercise don't necessarily have the best mental health. So it's not a case of it always being the more the better. Sort of firstly, the minimum effective dose, but then also at what point that kind of plateaus and then tips over into being, you know, potentially a negative thing.
Yeah. So let me come back to athletes, because they're a very sort of specialist group of people with unique pressures, in addition to what people like me or people who are not athletes have. So I'll come back onto that. But I think if we talk about the general population, so people who are not athletes, who are not competing at a high level, which is, it's just the bulk of the population, we continue on average to see an accumulation of mental health benefits in a nice steady increase linear way up to about 300 minutes per week. And then we tend to see a bit of a plateauing, so it levels off. You don't tend to see that increasing in mental health benefits per week. And then when you go too far, which is this other area which we're really interested in, which is a new and emerging area called quote unquote exercise addiction, we tend to see some negative effects for people who do not have an eating disorder but have a sort of a compulsion to continue exercising. We don't see those same mental health benefits. So that's the general trajectory within which we see. And then if we look at what's the minimal dose to improve people's mental health, if we look at like a one-off bout, we and others have been able to show that with just like a 15 or 20 minute amount of physical activity, you can actually get changes that are happening within the brain, and you can get a meaningful uplift as a one-off bout in terms of improving your mental health.
And I think that it would be really interesting to come onto that sort of exercise addiction topic. So I'm going to come back to that. But I would really love to talk to you about athletes as well, because I think you know, you sort of differentiate the two, and I can completely understand why. And I understand that specifically sort of competitive athletes, there are additional pressures there. But I think we're living in a time where we have something called the everyday athlete. You know, there are people who are competing at a relatively high level and putting their bodies through almost as much as, you know, some professional athletes might do. So I do think it's interesting that we talk about them as a sort of morphing group of people. So when it comes to athletes, talk to me about the kind of the research that you've done and what you found with that specific group.
Yeah, so you're right. Everybody is an athlete. We're all moving in our own different ways and we're all on our journey. But I think when we're talking about athletes, particularly those who are competing, there's often other things which need to be considered, such as, you know, financial rewards for competing or not competing, having a place if you're in a team, whether you are or aren't in a team, and when you become injured or you're in pain, you know, so there's a huge identity, particularly when you're a competing athlete, that happens within that. Then there's other, you know, pressures about where do you finish if you compete in a particular race, and then if you have time out because of injury, all of these things can really put added stress over and above. And I think the thing that can relate to everyday athletes and perhaps many of your audiences is that much of what we do in terms of sport and exercise and engaging in movement is very well sort of documented as well. So there's an increasing scrutiny in what we're doing is, you know, are we doing it right? Have we got the correct form? People will comment on stuff, you know, completely, even if we don't want them to. So there's an extra layer of scrutiny in all of these added components, fear of injury, trying to get back to compete, trying to beat personal best, and the internal drive, which many, you know, competing athletes have, all really go into play to the complexities of why it may be more of a burden for people with athletes who are trying to compete as well. And what we've shown with athletes is that you know, in actual fact, it's not really about doing more of physical activity and exercise. In fact, it's spending time to reassure them to have rest, have recuperation, to have downtime, and actually, you know, gearing down from the amount they're doing, particularly when people are coming back from an injury and you're rehabbing athletes, there's often a propensity to get back or to continue training when there's still a little niggle. And that's part of that competitive spirit, but it's also part of the pressures people feel. So it's really about, you know, changing people's thoughts and beliefs around that so people can reintegrate safely.
And do you also see that kind of at the end of athletes' career? Because we know that there's that big, you know, sort of shift towards the end of an athlete's career where they go, what the hell do I do next? You know, I'm actually currently staying with my friend who's a three-time Olympian. And I know that towards the end of her career, it's like, God, what, my whole life has been sport and competing and onto the next, and suddenly you're like, you know, what do I do next? Do you see that at the tail end as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a really fascinating thing, whether it is a planned or an unplanned, we'll call it retirement, you see this huge you know, sort of loss of identity and, you know, increasing sort of challenges placed upon people, because like you said, with your friend or other people, you've had this identity going on. And then in the case of Olympics, is people are sort of micromanaged, particularly at events where all of your meals are together, you're part of a team, part of this whole identity. And then when you come out of that setting and you're not in the Olympic team and you're not within these tournaments, you know, you're like, what do I do with myself? And then when it comes to the end of the career, people hit with this really big identity crisis, and the sort of the mental health challenges that people experience, if that's cut short due to injury or illness, then those can be even more profound. And I think there's a really interesting study within the NFL where they looked at this issue, and I think they found that around 50% of people who were playing in the American Football League and retired went on to go and have some, you know, mental health challenges. Wow. And, you know, all types of like financial issues as well. So this is a huge, huge issue.
I think that also translates that, you know, there was some research about how many footballers, don't quote me on this because I'm not the researcher here, but I'm sure there was something about how many footballers end up in debt post-retiring, and just sort of all sorts of financial and mental health issues as a result of that. I think is such an interesting area. Bringing us back to the exercise addiction conversation, you know, I'm someone who definitely counts myself as having recovered from potentially being in that space. And I think that it's a difficult term because what is exercise addiction and how do we quantify it and diagnose it? So talk to me about what you know thus far about exercise addiction, you know, how you define it, and then also what the impacts of it are.
First of all, I will say I hate the term exercise
addiction.
Okay,
fine. It's only because you used it.
I used it. It is the term that's used. Yeah. So it's the term that's used, but I don't like
okay,
it.
Okay, fine.
I don't like it at all. So I just wanted to say that. So it is the term that's used in literature and people talk about. And when we're talking about exercise addiction, we recognize that in a spectrum, eating disorders happen on a spectrum. It's a core component of many people with an eating disorder, particularly anorexia nervosa. But outside of that, for people who don't have disordered eating, is we're recognizing, I had a PhD candidate do his whole PhD in this a few years ago, Mike Trott. And we're recognizing that there is a group of people who are unable to rest, continue to exercise when injured, and if they do are not able to exercise for a valid reason, I don't know, a family event or going away, it can cause people great distress. And actually stopping the exercise can cause people, distress and can affect people's personal relationships, can affect people's physical health because people continue to train beyond that, and it can have a sort of detrimental impact on people's mental health. And broadly speaking, is an inability to basically rest and not engage in exercise for a good reason. And what Mike did with his PhD work is showed that if you go into a typical gym, like a gym or a training environment, around 15% of people, if you use these screening questionnaires, would meet the criteria for having an exercise addiction. So that would be problematic exercise use, where it is sort of becoming, is dependent and it is having a negative impact on people's physical and mental health. So it is really quite common, and it's something which is really under researched and under talked about. And that is this sort of other end of the spectrum where clearly exercise is very good for you. But for some people, it can fall into this pattern of behavior where it becomes a dependence and it impacts people's social, psychological, and physical health.
15% is higher than I thought that was going to be. That's a crazy stat. And one of the things that I guess is therefore important to talk about is sort of recovery and whether that, you sort of described it as falling under the same kind of umbrella term of eating disorders. And this is the hard thing, right? Because we talk about exercise and there's so much positivity that surrounds that word, right? We talk about the benefits of exercise. And so I know in my experience, my exercise addiction was very much, well, this is a good thing, right? Surely this is good for me. And you are convinced that you're, just healthy and you're doing the right thing. And people also praise you for being dedicated and motivated. So how do you work with people, or was this something that he looked into as part of his PhD in terms of recovery tactics or overcoming exercise addiction?
So I think that what Mike's been doing, or Mike did in his PhD, was saying, can we come up with a way to identify people who are struggling with exercise addiction where it's impeding their psychological, physical, and social health? So he developed a screening tool so we can identify people. Then he looked at how common is this in people with and without eating disorders, and we showed that around 15% without eating disorders have this, potential cluster of symptoms, and obviously it's much more common in eating disorders. And then we're really moving on to what can we do to support people. Now we know that this is not a positive thing for people in the long term. And you're right, it is very easy to go on and find to be reinforced about this type of behavior if it is becoming problematic. And like with many of these things, is people often don't realize that is becoming problematic and often the last person to know about it. So what we're trying to do is trying to develop non-confrontational supportive ways to help people understand that it may be becoming problematic, and helping people to sort of reorganize their thoughts and their belief systems that exercise, that rest and recovery is absolutely vital for people. And it is all really about trying to get back to that place of balance.
Absolutely, yeah. And I, like, it's something that I'm really passionate about talking about. And I sort of feel like with my audience, I'm very clear on trying to say that as much as, my experience is going to be exactly the same as everyone else's, if there's any take home, it's that I completely, as you said, didn't realize how bad it had got until suddenly, you start having all these physical symptoms and wondering what's going on. And you realize that actually what you think is good for you is not actually as good for you as you thought. So that's really positive and definitely something that I think needs a lot of help within that space.
We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Give Me Strength.
Kind of moving on to your second pillar that you talked about and the more specific diagnoses, you mentioned things like schizophrenia, depression. I guess I'm someone who finds myself getting really frustrated with this kind of one size fits all approach of exercise is good for your mental health. Whatever you've got, it's going to be make it better. And I'm sure you'll be able to dig into that statement in itself, but how do you see yourself kind of giving this advice around exercise whilst also treading carefully and not making people feel as though it's their only option when it comes to dealing with quite, you know, challenging mental health issues and complex issues?
Yeah, you're right, Alice. It needs to be delivered really carefully. And I think from my own experience of managing my own mental health and having to seek help myself, as I kind of get it a bit, not only do I research this, but I've also received help myself. So it gives me a bit more of an insight. And we are careful. We can't be saying that exercise is going to cure all mental health conditions, because that's not true. On the same time, we can't say that medication is going to cure all mental health conditions, or we can't say that therapy is going to help all mental health conditions. So before we get into the specifics, it's good to get this balanced conversation out. The reality is that as part of treatment and help, exercise will help some people at some times, but not all people at all times. Just like at some times, therapy will be the best thing for people to start off with, or medication will. And these can all be part of a holistic part of treatment. And what's unhelpful when we're talking about the evidence, or I was talking at a conference to 500 psychiatrists at the weekend, we tend to just say exercise versus psychotherapy, or exercise versus medication. And those are helpful to understand how good is exercise or medication versus each other. But the reality is, for the treatment, is go and get the best help and as much help as you can at any one time. If you are able to get help from your doctor and they recommend taking a medication, you have that conversation, wonderful. If you are able to get therapy, have therapy. If you are able to do exercise and help and also work on your lifestyle, that is a wonderful combination. So I think it's having an honest conversation, is it will help some people, but it's not going to help all people. Like any intervention, is we cannot claim that it is ubiquitously good for all people at all times, because it's just simply not true.
One of the kind of key components of some of those conditions that we've spoken about is a lack of motivation. You know, let's talk about depression. You know, some of the symptoms can be losing all motivation, you know, and sort of feeling very low, not wanting to get out of bed. How do you navigate that conversation about exercise when people literally, you know, it feels so difficult for them to even get up and have a shower? You know, how do you get people to, I guess, consider doing some form of movement, which, like you said, in some people might be beneficial? In your research, have you kind of found ways in which that might be able to be implemented?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can talk about the research and then my own experience of going to help people who've been really unwell from being in a hospital bed and very, very depressed to being sort of in the community and perhaps having not such severe symptoms. And generally speaking, the conversation I will have with someone like that, it will be trying to understand what they enjoy and what they're capable of. So I wouldn't go in and start talking about exercise, or let's go and do this HIIT class, or let's go and do yoga. It would just be a case of often reassuring some of the sort of the facts that, for the great, you know, that just talking to people how they are, finding out if they're interested in movement. I will often not really talk about exercise unless the person brings it up, because not everyone's had a positive experience of exercise. I don't know, for instance, PE at school has not been very positive for people. And a lot of people I've met have found, oh, I don't exercise, this is not good for me. So I do a lot of reframing around what we're talking to in this context. And then my experience of helping people is that people often have quite low self-esteem as a core part of that motivational deficit you spoke about. So it's really a case of just reinforcing the message that if you are not feeling good, we can go and do any type of movement you want today, whether it be, you know, just a very simple walk. It can just be, you know, a minute, 2 minutes. We can go and do something if you would like to, that would feel beneficial for you. And then we can make sure that person experiences some success. Because when you are feeling depressed and have no motivation, if you're not able to achieve what someone is asking you to achieve, there's nothing like, you know, not achieving that to knock your confidence back. So it'll be a case of reframing the conversation, lowering the barrier to entry and supporting the person to engage in the experience of movement, and reinforcing that this can be any type of movement that you want. It doesn't need to be what you may have perceived exercise to be in the past. So all of those types of, these are really external motivational strategies, including education, just to enable and empower that person on that first day to if they're able to experience some movement. And then once we've been able to do that, then we'll sort of take it from there, perhaps in the next session.
I feel like that's really helpful advice as well for people who might have a friend or family member who's in that position, because we know that mental health services are, you know, stretched. And often it does fall to people like that to kind of try and work with someone to get them feeling, you know, better. I love what you said about sort of lowering that barrier to entry making it something that they feel like they've achieved rather than haven't met. And I think oftentimes we can project our biases onto someone, you know, oh, I do 30 minutes of HIIT a day, so that's going to be something that you need to do. It'll be great for you. And actually that can be sometimes the worst thing you can do for that person. Because again, like, you know, the gap between where they are and getting to that point is probably pretty huge. So I really love what you said in terms of the advice that you gave there, because I think that's going to be helpful, not just from more like a kind of clinical setting, but also for people that are helping those that they love.
Absolutely. And it's just really, you know, getting alongside that person and say, how can I be helpful and how can I support you in this particular place? So I really think there's just a great, I mean, we know that like social support and providing someone support and getting alongside them is one of the best ways we can help people to feel part of, because often with the case of depression, people can kind of not feel part of generally. So getting alongside and supporting someone is one of the best things we can do.
Are you happy to talk about your experience with mental health? Because as someone who kind of has all the evidence in their toolbox to know what's the best thing to do, I'm not going to say surprised, but I'm interested, I guess, to hear that was something that touched you and also then what you therefore did in that situation when you were struggling. So yeah, if you're comfortable too, I'd really be interested to hear about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had two bouts, but the last one I can speak about where I was really struggling with depression was about 2 years ago. And I had a few different life events which sort of led to me going into a sort of depressive episode. And I was really met with what you described, really low motivation. It was shortly or during sort of COVID and lockdown, as many people were impacted. And I just found myself unable to really leave my apartment, my flat, and all of my other lifestyle behaviors when I was eating loads of junk and not able to do anything. So my motivation was really, really low. And I was very fortunate to get help and support by an NHS service for NHS staff at that time. And what was actually really important for me was medication and therapy really helped me just to get that initial boost, because the thought of going to do something quite rigorous in terms of life changes, you know, exercise would have been too much for me at that time. I was able to go out with some friends and do some walks and some gentle stuff. And I knew all of this stuff. I knew what to do, but applying and getting over that motivational barrier was really difficult for me. But thankfully, I was able to get the help. And that was really important for me to give me that boost to take me up to the next level. And then once I found my mood lifting, then I was able to sort of really go in and really prioritize like my lifestyle, which has been really important for me to maintain my own mental health and sort of leading up to, you know, the sort of dip. And when I had my depressive episode was when I wasn't able to exercise and had a number of other stressors going on as well. So for me, it's been really important. And when I had that episode I couldn't engage in things. So medication and therapy were enormously helpful for me and really enabled me to sort of take my lifestyle and exercise and everything to the next level. So I will always speak very highly about my experience with those approaches too. Very complimentary for me.
And I think that's so important, because I think oftentimes people can feel like they've either like failed or they've done something wrong if they have to lean on things like medication or therapy rather than just being able to be like, oh, I just exercised my depression away. So it's so good to hear someone like yourself saying, I actually lent on multiple tools to kind of recover from that bout of depression. I really appreciate you sharing that. It kind of brings me on to my next question, which is about, I guess, the bigger picture or the bigger pieces of the pie when it comes to making ourselves feel good. We've talked about exercise a lot and kind of movement being one of those big pillars of what we know makes us feel good. But I'm interested if there's research that you've done that shows kind of the interplaying of all the different things. So whether that's nutrition, sleep, environmental stress in general, like what have you found in terms of the connection between all of these things? I guess we now know the importance of those things when it comes to feeling our best. So yeah, I'd be interested to know what you found.
Yeah, so we've done a few studies looking at this, what we call multiple lifestyle behaviours. And it's important to say that there are life events and life challenges that are going to happen to us. And even if we are eating wonderfully, sleeping wonderfully, eating wonderfully, all of those things, we are going to be stretched. And really what the research and the evidence has shown is that if we do these behaviors, then it increases our resilience and our ability to be able to manage these. But there are going to be sometimes some things that happen to us where it doesn't matter what we're doing, that, you know, we will have challenges that go beyond that. So I think speaking within that, we've looked at multiple lifestyle behaviors and the promotion of better mental health. And one good study we did was in the UK Biobank, which is a huge cohort of people, around 200,000 people. And we looked at how does movement, what we eat, sleep, and also mindfulness practices influence our mental health. And we've generally shown that potentially each of these have an individual component, but you get the best protection and the best improvement in mental health when you combine all of these individual approaches. So when people are moving more on average, when people are eating sort of more nutritious food, less ultra processed food, we had a paper come out on that last week, on ultra processed food and depressive symptoms. When people are sleeping more than 6 hours a day, but not lots, because that's also an indication of someone who's struggling with their mental health as well, and then also engaging in other mindfulness outdoor practices as well too. So generally, combining all of these offers the best protection and the best improvement for our mental health.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of feeds into what we already know, but I think sometimes we can place so much of a heavy weight on one of those things rather than, you know, being a little bit more. And again, I think it feeds back into that sort of conversation that we're having about exercise addiction. Like for me, I was just so focused on the exercise and you sort of forget the other components. You know, my sleep was going out the window and other things were happening. So I do think it's really good to sort of talk about the balance of those things and creating a nice harmony of all those things kind of playing in into making ourselves feel at our best. Moving on to talk about one of the important factors of exercise, which is motivation. When I scrolled through your Instagram, you had a post on this, and I find it really fascinating because, you know, like for most people at some point in our lives, we struggle. I know I've definitely been there where I struggle with my motivation. You have dips, you have months, even years where you can sort of really drop off and feel as though you're not motivated to exercise. And I know that this is something that you've looked into. So everyone wants the secret formula, right? How do we stay motivated to exercise for the rest of our lives? Give us the details. Like what do we know helps to boost and improve motivation when it comes to moving our bodies?
So I wish I could give you a 1-2-3 formula, but it's not that simple.
I know.
But actually there is a simple tip.
Okay.
And for all of us, the challenge, particularly when we're struggling with our mental health, is that physical activity and movement requires exertion. So by definition, it requires us to do something which is which requires effort. And that's more difficult when our mental health is compromised. So in order for all of us to continue to experience the benefits of movement, the key really is consistency. So being consistent in what we're doing, just doing something every day or every other day. And now I'm not talking about doing excessive amounts, such as doing, I don't know, I'll let people define what an excessive amount is. But if you're doing lots of really high intensity movement every day, then that's not a good thing. But doing small amounts with some higher intensity intervals, I don't know, every other day or every 3 days, is good for you. And we know that in order to keep engaging the behavior, if we keep doing it, then we're much more likely to keep doing it. So consistency when we're not feeling particularly good is really, really important. And we've shown within the exercise literature that consistency and frequency, how often we do it, is much more important than intensity. So there's often been a focus on, yes, we must go really hard, really fast, but that's really difficult for a lot of people. And if you go and have a really intense session, and then particularly if you don't have recovery, then the thought of going out and doing that again, because you think this is what it must involve, just becomes a barrier for people. So the key thing is not to focus on intensity too much, focus on consistency. And then when you become consistent, then you can try and increase the time and also the intensity with which you're doing. So consistency is the winner for engaging and maintaining motivation.
What about enjoyment?
And enjoyment, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the key. That is another key. So enjoyment is key for all of us to going back into movement, is going back to find a movement that we enjoy, and then we're much more likely to go and do it. We've shown that with large cohorts of people, and that shows common sense, is if you find a movement or an exercise that you find stimulating, you enjoy, and it's fun, then you're much more likely to keep doing it and build into that consistency. Whereas if you go and have a really terrible experience or don't like, I don't know, badminton or yoga and Pilates, and you keep suggesting doing that, then it's just not going to happen. So consistency and enjoyment and fun are the key sort of factors why we keep going.
I think the reason why I mention enjoyment is because I think, you know, the more we know about exercise, and especially, you know, in your opening sort of response, you talked about the importance of cardiovascular exercise and also strength exercises. And I think that a lot of people, particularly right now, and this is the conversation I'm having with a lot of people that follow me, is like, oh, should I be including this? Do I need to be including that? And often these aren't things that they actually enjoy. Like I've spoken to some women who just don't like lifting weights or doing strength training. And so I think there's this pressure of, oh, this is what I should be doing versus what do I genuinely enjoy doing and what am I able to do consistently over a period of time? And so I think it's trying to encourage people to, yes, okay, on paper, we know that these two things matter. And if you can try and find ways of doing those two things that you enjoy, great. But ultimately, and what I'm hearing from you is at the heart of it all, it's staying consistent with a form of movement that you enjoy being more important than necessarily ticking like the more specific boxes of what that type of movement is.
Absolutely. And particularly when we're looking at the mental health benefits and the brain health benefits, you know, you see comparable for different types of movement. And we tend to have this artificial construct, or this is aerobic exercise, or this is strength exercise. And the reality is, you know, if you're doing, take running for an example, is you are actively contracting your muscles, albeit in a different way, and we just have these artificial constructs. And for your body or your mind, if you're able to keep running or walking and you're able to do that consistently over a longer period of time, that's going to be better for your brain and mental health than if you just do resistance training for 4 weeks and then you don't do anything afterwards because you really don't like it. So it's all about sticking with the key source of being consistent and finding something you enjoy. Longevity is the game.
Love that advice, and definitely something that I agree with. Of all the research that you've worked on, and there is a lot, over 700 different papers, which ones stick out to you as being of great importance? And I realize this is a really difficult question, but are there any that really stick in your mind or that you found have been particularly impactful on the fitness and wellbeing space?
Oh, good question. So I think just the culmination of things that we're really changing the conversation now, that there's really good evidence and data for the mental health benefits of exercise. I think that's the most pleasing thing. And I think before I come into the fitness space, I think within the health space generally, is we've written a number of guidelines, which has really brought together the evidence and the implementation, where we have made recommendations at a UK, a European and a world level to say that in that caveats we spoke about earlier, that as an option, as part of a menu of treatment options for people struggling with their mental health, is physical activity and exercise for those who are able and capable and interested should be part of a menu of options. And we've made guidelines within that. So I think that's one of the greatest achievements myself and colleagues have had within that. Then I think we've done some pretty cool studies. So we a few of the neurobiological studies we've done have been quite cool and interesting. So we've shown that for people who are struggling with their mental health, that there is a smaller area of the brain called the hippocampus. And this is important for emotional processing and memory and is reduced in depression, dementia and other things. We've shown that over a period of time, you can increase the size of this area within the brain and you can stimulate it within a one-off session with 15 to 20 minutes. And that is just absolutely amazing in terms of changing the actual structure of the brain and changing the electrical activity in the brain. We've done other studies showing stimulation of BDNF from this exercise too. And I think in terms of the messaging around exercise and mental health, we've also been looking at what are the mental health benefits from engaging in exercise when you don't see any change in weight, because as you know, and your listeners, I'm sure, will be aware of this preoccupation of the aesthetics and the weight changes from engaging in exercise. But we've shown that if you see no change in weight, that you see meaningful improvements in people's fitness and mental health in the absence of weight. So the good news is you're seeing improvements in mental health, you're seeing improvements in fitness that improve longevity, all these other things, but you're not seeing changes in weight. So do not become despondent if you are focusing on weight, that there's no changes. You're seeing real meaningful improvements in your fitness and also your mental health. So some of those messages, which we're trying to reframe with evidence and data, has been particularly pleasing to you.
Just honestly, you're doing the most incredible work. And I think that it's so exciting what you have to come. And I guess that brings me to my final question, which is, looking forwards, are there gaps that you feel still need filling when it comes to what we know about exercise and mental health? I mean, obviously there's probably a lot, but ones that you're most interested in looking into, I'd love to hear about kind of what you have on the horizon and what you're most interested in delving into next.
So I'll say there's three things that we're looking at, I think, are really important. So things we're looking at the moment is, first and foremost, is we're seeing a worrying trend that young people are, on average, tend to engage in lower levels of physical activity and sedentary behaviour. And this is related to mental health. So we're really concerned about that relationship, and we want to develop interventions to help young people to experience the joys and the benefits of movement on average. So that's a really important area from a public health perspective. So we did some work recently showing that around 17% of Gen Zs were engaging in physical activity three or more times a week, whereas if you looked at the silent generation, 59% of those, when they were that age, were engaging in physical activity and exercise. So there's this widening gap for for some people, and we're concerned about this. The other area, we're really interested in the neurobiological mechanisms. So one cool study we're just finishing at King's now is we're looking at exercise and the role on changes of the hippocampus, and then we're looking at changes in the gut microbiome, and does changes in the gut microbiome influence those changes in the brain and the protection on people's cognition and their mental health. And I think that's a really interesting area to look at, that gut-brain axis and its response to exercise too. And then I think really in terms of research and what we need to do is we've got loads of evidence and data now. What we really need to do as a research and the wider community, including like yourself and others, is to come together and say, how can we bring all of this evidence together? And how can we implement this to impact people's lives in a positive way? How can we disseminate evidence-based information and provide inclusive movement programs so that all people can experience these mental health benefits? We don't really need another 700 academic papers from me or anyone else. We really need to get on to implementing what works and making a real difference to real people's lives.
Well, honestly, if there's anything that I can do, that first sort of real conversation around the younger generation being more sedentary is a huge thing that I am interested in. So yeah, like let's see if we can work together in some way, because I think that would be really beneficial. But it also, it's one of those things where, people like yourself and people like myself, we all play a role in this kind of, in this space. And you're right, it's about creating synergy between all of us in order to have impactful change, because we all care and we all want to make a difference, but it's about, best practice and how we go about doing that. So hopefully off the back of this and other things that we can really make some impactful change. So Brendan, thank you so much. If people want to find you, I will put Brendan's social handles in the show notes, but I just really appreciate your time. I know that you're incredibly busy. So thank you so much for jumping on and for sharing all of your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I'll be back on Friday for my Ask Alice. Again, if you have any questions for that, send us an email to the email that's in the show notes. If you are enjoying the podcast and you'd like to hear a little more from me, I am so excited to announce that I have just written my latest book, Give Me Strength, How I Turned My Back on Restriction, Nurtured the Body I Love, and How You Can Too. It comes out in July and is available for pre-order now. And it's the book I wish I had read when I was really struggling with body image and exercise addiction. And so if this sounds like something that might help you, you can find the link to get your copy in the show notes now. I'll be back next Wednesday for my next episode, and I look forward to speaking to you then. Give Me Strength is an Insanity Studios production.